As I said last week, I want to encourage you to ask questions, encourage you to, if I say something, because as I listened to last week's study, I realized I did probably about an hour and a half worth of stuff in about 40 minutes, and so I was talking so fast. I don't want to lose you, and I don't want you to get to a place where you have to, you say, I don't understand what he was talking about. I want you to be able to ask a question as we go. And there are going to be some things, because I'm the one teaching it, that I'm just going to camp at a place, because I think it's interesting, and I think it may be interesting to you. There may be other places that I pass, and you say, wait a minute, what about this? And I'll be free to ask if I know, or free to talk about it as we go. So tonight, we're really going to cover from Noah to when Adam is born. And we're going to do that just looking at a couple of little snapshots. As I told you last week, we really don't know a whole lot from Adam and Eve to Noah. All we have is what Moses has recorded in a couple of genealogies in Genesis chapter 5. And then we go straight into Noah. There's some things we know about Noah. If you remember reading about Noah, if you've read the genealogies about Noah, we know that Noah is a descendant from Seth. Seth, who was one of Adam and Eve's children. Seth is supposedly the godly child. The line of Seth was considered the more spiritual of the lines that followed down to Noah from Adam. And so that included Methuselah, who many people remember is the oldest person listed. Methuselah lived 969 years. Lamech, who was Noah's grandfather, or Noah's dad, lived to be 777. Enoch, who was Methuselah's dad, was the shortest lived person. You can go read that genealogy because it tells us that God took him to heaven. Now, we don't know what that means. He only lived 300 and something years. But understand, when we talk about these times, just like the dating that I'm giving you, if you look at that sheet and you see all these dates on here, that's all guesses. That is speculation on the best historians and the best things that archaeologists have discovered. The way that we come about dating some of these things in Bible history is by looking at the archaeology of different things that have been found and then tracing it over to what we know is going on in the Bible at the same time those things archaeology had found. And so when we say that Methuselah lived to be almost 1,000 years old, just like I told you, we don't literally know if God created the heavens and the earth in seven literal 24-hour periods. We don't know, because time and the measurement of time didn't happen until after Methuselah was alive. Really, until sometime around Abraham's time do we begin to see the measurement of time in a day, what we would call 24 hours. And so take that with a grain of salt. Noah, we know, lived to be 950 years old. He was about 600, the Bible tells us, when the ark was built. And I wanted to, there's a verse, part of chapter 6, as we get into the flood, that always seems to have people asking questions. And so I really wanted to just look at it for a few minutes and really talk about it, because it seems to be a troubling passage for some, before we get into looking at the setting of when Abraham was born. So, and I've listed on there Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 4. And it talks about three groups of people: the sons of God, the daughters of man, and a group called the Nephilim. And a lot of people read this. If you went and saw Russell Crowe's version of Noah, which was probably one of the better versions. There's not a good version. You know, you have to realize all we know about Noah is captured in about 15 verses, 20 verses here. And so anything that you hear about Noah is speculation. His relationship with his wife and the people that he was around and how they acted, all that speculation. So, you know, it's a guess. But the one thing that Russell Crowe's version did bad is they had the group called the Nephilim, and they portrayed them as these rock creatures, whereas others have portrayed them as giants, because the word Nephilim means giant in Hebrew. And so they portrayed them as these giant people in some of the other versions of Noah. This passage confuses a lot of people, and so I wanted to help clarify for it. It said in verse 6:1, when men began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. And then the Lord said, my spirit will not contend with this man forever, for he is mortal, and his days will be 120 years. Now, in ancient literature, 120 years is just a perfect life. It's not a literal 120 years. That was a full life. They would say that when someone lived to be 120 years, they lived a complete life. And so it's not God condemning and saying, from now on, man's only going to live to be 120 years old, because not many of us today live to be 120 years old. And so that's really not a literal understanding of there. And then it said, the Nephilim were on the earth in these days, And also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of man and had children by them, they were the heroes of old, men of renown. What is it talking about? The sons of God and the daughters of men. For probably 4,000 years, people assumed this was talking about angels. Really, because there is a non-canonical book, which is a biblical literature book called the Book of Enoch, which you can find in some different translations. In the Book of Enoch, it talks about a group of angels, 200 or so angels, and it gives one of the head angels a name, and they look down on the earth and they lust after the women on the earth. And because they lust after them, they come to earth and they marry the women of the earth. And they have children who are part angel and part human. And these angels are giants or superhumans. And so that was considered true. The correct interpretation of this all the way through right around the time Jesus was born, because Josephus, who is a Jewish historian, also records the same interpretation of what this passage means, that these were angels. And so the common Jewish interpretation was angels came and had sex with women, human women, and they produced this super race of people. You can see that because of the terminology sons of men or sons of God. But the problems that come from that is the Bible clearly says in Mark 12:25 that angels don't marry. Mark says that the angelic beings do not marry, will not get married. And matter of fact, they do not have physical bodies. So they do not have the capacity to marry. So the New Testament kind of discounts this idea that these were angels that came and laid with them. And then the whole setting, the reason this is in Genesis 6:1, 2, 3, and 4, 5, is because it's laying a foundation of why God decides to destroy the earth. Because these evil men were taking advantage of beautiful earthly women and having these giants, and God said, I'm done with people. Well, if the reason God said I'm done with people is because angels were sleeping with humans, then maybe he should have flooded heaven instead of flooding earth, right? I mean, just the literal idea. If that was the case, then that's not really a good reason, because it's not really humans' fault if angels, these angelic beings, were coming and seducing these women. And so that interpretation, by the time the New Testament had fallen away, but you'll still hear people talk about it. And you'll still hear people teach it. That's called the cosmological mixed race theory. And so I didn't list that because you don't need to know that. You just need to know that you'll still hear people, and especially those that are raised in the Catholic faith, because in the Catholic faith, they still use some of the Book of Enoch. And so you will find some of those in the Catholic faith that will make reference to the Book of Enoch, and it'll talk about angels sleeping or laying with humans. The second theory, which became very prominent about the time of, after this view went away, about the time of Jesus, was called the religious mixed group. And what it says is that this group, sons of God, dealt with the descendants of Seth, who was considered the godly son. And the godly son's descendants married Cain's descendants, and Cain was considered the evil son. And so the godly son, what they're saying is the angel, the sons of the angels or sons of God who were the godly set, intermarried with these people that were descendants of Cain who were bad or evil or cursed, and that is what caused the corruption to come upon the earth. And that was very, and I still hear people teach that because of the tradition of Seth. In the Old Testament, the tradition was Seth was the godly line. Noah is a descendant of Seth, and since Noah was a righteous man, then it is the descendant of Seth. Cain was the evil one and cursed, and so they intermarried, and God said, I'm not going to have good and evil intermarrying, so I'm going to destroy the earth. But the problem with that is what about good and evil marrying created giants or created these Nephilim? They both had the same DNA. Whether you were spiritually evil or spiritually good, you had the same DNA. Just because you mixed, you didn't create a whole different race. So that's the problem. What most people believe is what's called a sociological mix. And that's what I hold. That's what most people today hold, is that this term sons of God was a self-identifying term that many of the kings and rulers of the day used for themselves. If you go and study, even during Abraham's time and after Abraham's time, most of the rulers, even if you go to England during the Middle Ages, what did they call themselves? They called themselves God's chosen, right? That they were, why am I a king? Charlemagne, I'm a king chosen by God. And that goes all the way back to ancient times. And so what I believe, what many people believe, is that is just a self-title of despotic rulers. These are these rulers that identified themselves as being better than everybody else because they were the sons of God, and they were taking advantage of commoners, women that were commoners. And now this is nothing. In medieval England, medieval Europe, kings had the right of first refusal, which meant that on a commoner's wedding night, that the king could sleep with the bride first because he was the king and he was chosen by God. And he could go to any of his, you know, a duke or a feudal lord could go and choose to be with any of the women that were in his, under his lordship. And that was, you had to submit to him because that's just the rule. Same type of thing. What was happening is these despotic kings were going into some of these villages and taking advantage, and they were creating what's called Nephilim. Now, Nephilim, which many people interpret as being giant, we find again in Numbers chapter 13. It's only mentioned twice in the Bible. But in Numbers 13, it's used to describe evil princes or princes of the day who had been evil people. And so basically what I think Moses is saying here in Genesis, now it's not angels coming and sleeping with humans and creating these rock men or giants or whatever. It's just basic sociology. These evil kings were coming in and they were taking advantage of villagers, and they were evil and they were ruling over them and they were forcing themselves upon them. These women were becoming pregnant, and their children, because they were the progeny of these sons of God, thought themselves better than everybody else because my dad was a son of God, or he is the, you know, son of the angels. And so they were despotic rulers in and of themselves. And that caused God to say, I've had enough. Not only is man not going to live that much longer, but I'm going to wipe them out. And so that is probably the most popular interpretation of what takes place there. And I'm going to try, you know, as we go through this, to look at some of these things that give people problems and bother people. Verses that are hard, verses that are difficult to understand, and try to give you some basic understanding if we can. And so that takes us to the flood. I'm not going to go into the details of the flood. We talked a little bit about it last week, where it happened. Most people believe, in the map I showed you last week, most people believe Fertile Crescent, remember, Mesopotamia. The word Mesopotamia means between two rivers. The Garden of Eden here was in this area, between the Tigris and Euphrates River. Most people believe that by the time of Noah was settling somewhere around here, around Nimrod, which became Nineveh later. And so this area floods. This, that you can't see on this map, is Mount Ararat. And that's where many people believe that Noah's Ark is still resting today. Those that have said they've seen it or have documentation, it's on Mount Ararat. And so from that, Noah's children spread out. Okay, all of this is after Noah's children. What this is just, this is the time of Abram, which we'll look at in 2 weeks. And I've superimposed where it is today so you can get an idea of where it is today. What I've got on the map that's on the back of your sheet is to show you where the Bible says the three sons of Noah. Noah had three sons, Japheth, Shem, and Ham. And you can read about them in Genesis chapter 9 and 10. It tells us where they spread out to. And so what you've got there is just a different picture of the same area, more spread out. And the names that are listed in Genesis 9 and 10 about where the three sons and their people spread out. And if you were to go and read, you can see what it says. Japheth, who was the oldest son, he was the blessed son. He takes most of the northern areas. And so this area, all of this is Japheth's. And so why do we say that Japheth takes the northern area? Well, if Mount Ararat is where the ark landed, then being the oldest son, then you have to figure Noah settled in this area. And so then you say the oldest son inherits the father's land, so the oldest son inherits this area. Now, I've seen maps that show that what listed as Tarshish, which is Italy and Greece, all being settled by Japheth. So that's what's represented. And you can see some of the older names that are listed. in Genesis chapters 9 and 10, Gomer, Magog, all of those things that fall under Japheth. And then the second son is Shem. And Shem was the one who we follow in all the genealogies because Shem is the leader of the Semitic people. And when I say Semitic people, that is the Sumerians. And that is the people that settled in Mesopotamia that I showed you in the picture area. Shem settled in all this area, which remember, this is Saudi Arabia, and it goes all the way up into Turkey, part of Turkey, and then into the Middle East, Iran, Iraq, that area. But Shem settles in all of this area. Shem is where Abraham comes from, Shem's line. If you follow the genealogies that go from Shem all the way to Joseph, all the way to Jesus, they'll say that the genealogies will trace it all the way back. And Shem is always known as the father of Semitic people, which is the Arab people which Abram came out of or was listed as. And then you had the cursed son, Ham. And Ham takes over all what was known as Cush. He takes some of the part of the Red Sea here, which is in all of North Africa. But he also takes the Holy Land, as what we know of as the Holy Land, is part of his land, which is Canaan. And Canaan was Ham's son's name. If you go and read the genealogy, and Ham's son, Canaan, was cursed. Do you remember why Ham and Canaan were cursed? Anybody remember the story? Looked on Noah naked. Why was Noah naked? He got drunk after he landed the ark, which is understandable. You've been that long on a boat with cooped up with animals and stuff. You know, and let's just be honest. He cooped up with a family and all these animals, and he gets off the ark and he drinks and he gets drunk. He passes out, and we don't know if he's naked or we don't know if his robes were open. I mean, I think the literal Hebrew is that he fell out and his robes splayed open. Japheth and Shem came and wanted to come and cover him up, and Ham laughed at him because he was the youngest son, and the youngest sons are always that way, right? So they're always the troublemakers, and so Ham laughed at him. And so when Noah wakes up, what does he say? Japheth and Shem I bless, Ham I curse, Canaan, which we assume, you know, Canaan was already born, his oldest son, he said, Canaan I curse. And so there's been, from that time till now, this idea of what does that mean to be the curse of Ham? If you grew up in the South up until about 50 years ago, it was taught in most churches and it was taught in most places that the curse of Ham was black color. Okay? I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard that. I've listened to sermons that were preached in the 40s and 50s and 60s that directly list the curse of Ham being African Americans, and the reason they're black and the reason that they've had all of the trials that they've had is because God cursed Ham, and they are descendants of Ham. This area is Africa, but the problem with that is this is also the Middle East. Canaan, which his land does become cursed because this is the land that ends up being the Holy Land. Ends up being the Promised Land. It ends up getting taken away from Canaan's descendants because they are cursed. But I can't tell you how many people, even today, I promise you, there are churches where you will have people that will talk about the curse of Ham being somebody that's African American. Anybody heard that? Have anybody, that's not new? Yeah. Noah cursed him. And it wasn't because the color, okay? Now, because the people over here are dark. And the people that are over here are dark. And so the idea that the cursing was a skin color is not even understandable or biblical. But I can remember the 70s getting into an argument, late 70s getting into an argument about why whites couldn't intermarry other races, because you would bring the curse of Ham into your family if you married into other races.
What is the word, original word used for curse? Does it mean like putting a curse on someone?
It does mean, it's not necessarily I curse you as much as I wish, I hope that this happens to you. Yeah, it's anger. It's anger. It's not as in the cursing as what we would say as like a witch would curse somebody. And because we don't have an idea First of all, as you said, it was Noah that did the cursing. It wasn't God that did the cursing. Now, I believe there was, in Ham's generation, there was a generational curse, if you will, as much as it was not a curse per se of evil, but it was just a generational sin that resulted because of Ham and what Noah said to him. And I believe it had to do with immorality, because the cultures that came from Ham, even up into this area, were known as the most immoral cultures of their day. Okay, the Egyptians, the North Africans, had no morality. Okay, this area, Shem, is where we get where Abram comes from. The Semitic area and the Semitic people were some of the first moral people. Hammurabi's code, which is the first code of law, comes from this area. Governments, right and wrong, comes from this area, from Shem. From this area, we get brutality and slavery and sexual immorality. The very first Egyptian kingdoms that we know of were free sexual and free sexualities. There was androgynous. There was no gender recognition between male and female. That's why if you look at early ancient Egyptian drawings that we have, all of the people, there are no masculine features. If you notice that, even the men look women. Even the men look like they have a feminine features. And then what do we know about this area? Let me go back to this map. Abraham's going to make a trip that we're going to study in 2 weeks from Ur of the Chaldees. He's going to come up here, and he's going to come around over here, and he's going to run into some towns that are around here that are pretty immoral, right? Sodom and Gomorrah, Tyre, some of these other areas that he runs into. You know whose land this was? Canaan. And so I believe that's what he's talking about when he talks about the curse of Canaan and how that operates. And so, any questions about that? So, go ahead.
I'm curious, like, culturally, the family and that, when, you know, kind of like you said about the cursing, would that be, if a father's doing that, does that mean he's put out of a family?
Because he was still blessed. It was just basically saying, because of your actions, you're going to reap these things. Okay, and because you mocked me in a sexual manner is what I believe in the Hebrew, and a lot of scholars believe is that because you mocked me in a sexual manner and you made fun of this, then sexual immorality is going to follow your generation from here into the next generation, to the next generation, to the next generation. And I believe in generational curses. I don't believe that the devil puts generational curses, but I believe sexual immorality, I believe crime, I believe issues that we struggle with, sins that we struggle with, if we don't tear down those barriers, they go from generation to generation to generation. And sociologists will tell you that, psychologists will tell you that the sins of the father will be visited on the children and the children's children and the children's children. That doesn't have to happen. I believe because of the cross, we can break any curse. But I believe there are generational curses, you know, and I'm not talking about alcoholism or those kind of things, although those may be more in our physiology than in our genealogy. And so, but that sets the tone for Genesis chapter 11, and that spreads them out. Genesis chapter 11 is where we have the Tower of Babel. Tower of the Babel, we assume, because of the listing and what it talks about here, took place in the Semitic empires, which were in this area because of Mesopotamia. And the Sumerian Empire right here was one of the very first empires that ever took place. They were the first ones to build cities. Northern Egypt at the same time, and I've given you some dates there, and those aren't really as clear. Those are all guesses, what people normally figure the early dynastic periods, 2900, but that's not the very first Sumerian people. The Sumerian people were around from about 4,000, 4,500 in this area after Noah, and until they began to form into cities. They were the first people to form into cities, even before the Egyptian Empire. You had a northern Egyptian Empire, which was here, and the southern Egyptian Empire, which is always backwards. If you studied Egyptian history, the southern Egyptian empire is the one closest to the Mediterranean. The northern Egyptian empire was the one furthest away, which you would think of south, but they go according to the Nile River because the Nile River flows from south to north. And so the northern empire of Egypt was at the headwaters of the Nile. The southern empire, which was at the where it blended in. And so they were already having people groups, but they were not a civilization. So we believe that this idea of the Tower of Babel comes from that. And the reason is because we have documentation, archaeology, that has shown that ziggurats, which were places of worship, had been around in the Sumerian region from about 3500 on. And we believe that that was the idea of this Tower of Babel. Up until this time, everybody spoke the same language. Okay, and so some people say, well, weren't everybody together and then they spread out? No, it's just that as they spread out from this area, that languages begin to diversify and spread out. And so that's where the Tower of Babel comes in the language. And I've given you a picture of a ziggurat. This is the very first. This is actually a chalk drawing from a stele, which is a stele is a piece of rock that they found in the Sumerian Empire. This stele that has the ziggurat of Nebuchadnezzar that dates sometime about 1500 BC. This is actually on what is on the stele, and this is their worship, and this is what a ziggurat looks like. It looks like hat boxes, smaller and smaller, stacked on top. And the idea behind, and this is just looking at it from an overview, what it looked like looking down, and then there's some Semitic cuneiform that was written in the side. And so many people believe that's what the Tower of Babel looked like, because they built these towers not so that men could reach to God, but so that God could come down to man. Because you remember the question that man asked. If you remember, God asked, where is man? Man asked, where is God? And so they're in the Sumerian Empire, they are beginning to try to figure out, who is God? Who is God? And so they build this ziggurat thinking that as they grow in culture, they can begin to entice God to come down and visit them because of their advanced knowledge. It's the same thing in the Egyptian Empire. The Egyptian Empire built statues and pyramids so that God could have a way to come down and visit man. The Egyptians were worshiping the sun god Ra. The Sumerians were worshiping four or five different gods. But somewhere around 2000 BC, 2500 BC, we began to see for the very first time in the Sumerian Empire that they began to move from a polytheistic, which meant a bunch of gods, to more of a monotheistic principle. And that's the fertile ground that Abraham comes out of. Because what we find in writings that in that time period in the Sumerian Empire is that they began to believe in a personal God, a God that was your family God. You can see them. If you go to a museum, you'll see these little personal gods. They're little statues that they would form and create, and that they became their personal gods, and they would have them in their home, and they were there for protection, and they had a relationship with this personal God. Before that, they worshipped the sea and the stars and the sun.
Didn't Abraham's father, wasn't he a...
He was an idol maker. He was polytheistic, but he created these personal gods. And so for Abraham, and not to get ahead, or Abram, he began to like this idea of one God. And so when Yahweh, creator God, speaks to Abram, automatically he begins to equate it with a personal God. And that's the first time that we see that in any civilizations. Really, at this time, and I listed them there on your sheet, there are really only two civilizations that we recognize in the world. There was the Egyptian civilization and the Sumerian civilization. When I say civilizations, the Sumerians I listed on there, some of their discoveries, one of their first main kings was Sargon. And we have all kinds of archaeology finds that talk about Sargon. Matter of fact, you've probably seen statues of Sargon's face. He has this chain-looking beard, long chained beard and a long face and a pointed hat. They found statues of Sargon all over the Middle East. He was the first military dictator, had the first standing army. He created taxes. So you can thank Sargon for taxes. And so he created taxes. He established the very first government. He was to begin to use universal weights and measurements. And all this was happening to 200 BC to 250 BC, he began to talk medicine and mathematics and science. All that started in the Sumerian Empire. And so I've listed the main parts of the Sumerian Empire, the dynastic period. Akkad, which was the king that took over after Sargon. Ur the Third was the last of the great Sumerian leaders, and that was when Abraham came up in Ur of the Chaldees. Oh, let me say something else about this. How many of you have been to the Mayan or the Aztec ruins in Central America or South America? Anybody? What do they look like? You would say, well, how in the world can a civilization that's in South America 1,000 to 2,000 years after the Sumerians built a ziggurat, built temples that looked exactly the same? Was it a coincidence? Did they just happen to say, hey, let's build something like this? It wasn't. There was a connection between people groups. And we don't know, maybe Ezekiel, maybe other things. But it's one of those things that God had a plan when I tell you all of history. So Abram is born during the last of the Sumerian Empire before the Babylonians come in. And the Babylonians come in and take over this area, and they don't give it up until the Greeks come and Alexander the Great comes and destroys them, and then the Persians come and take them over. So this when he is born and he comes, now he leaves before the Babylonians take over, but it's at the last breath of the Sumerian Empire. But the Sumerian Empire, okay, Iraq and Iran, that's the cradle of civilization. And the Sumerian Empire was the first empire that we can say was a civilized empire because they had a form of government and they built cities. Egypt did the same thing. And I put down there just some hints on the Egyptian kingdom. And again, I reminded you, pyramids were built during the United Kingdom. The kingdoms were divided. They were united sometime around 3100 BC. The pyramids were built between 3100 and 3500 BC. So as I told you last week, the pyramids were 2,000 years old almost by the time that Abram came on the scene. So when Abram makes a trip, remember Abram ends up going to the Sinai. The pyramids are already 2,000 years old. They've been around a long time when he showed up. And so those are the two oldest empires. And I just listed in there the old Babylonian Empire, 2,000 to 1,600. That's when most of the patriarchal fathers fall in. That's when we have Joseph. That's when we have Joseph going to Egypt, is at the beginning of what's called the Hyksos rule. But it's also during the end of the old Babylonian Empire. And then most of the captivity takes place during the Hyksos rule, during the 17th dynasty in Egypt. And we'll talk more about that when we get into Egypt. But I wanted you to see just how all this is, it's all growing and working together. It all starts here and it spreads out from here. Any questions? Questions about it? Here's what I'm going to do. 2 weeks. Next week, come and eat. Soup and salad. We'll fellowship. And then 2 weeks, I'm going to talk about Abram. And we're going to talk about the culture that Abram, how did we go from a polytheistic culture to Yahweh? Who was God? Where does this idea of God, Creator, Yahweh, besides Noah, you know, Moses put all this together. But where does this idea come from? And so I'm going to show you how Abram takes this concept of a personal God, and when he gets visited by God, and God creates a covenant with him. And that's not the first covenant. God created a covenant with Noah. We're going to talk about what the covenant means, because covenant is still important to us today, because it is the covenant we have with Jesus Christ that gives us salvation. And so we're going to talk about how important that word is. It gets used a lot in the Old Testament. We're also going to talk about Abram's journeys, how he developed, and the idea of promised land, and how the idea of where the promised land, you know, Abraham is the God of the three major world religions. Was Abraham when it happened, but all the three world religions, the largest world religions, all started with Abraham. Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. So all three of those we can give credit to, or we can blame Abram. And so the battles that go on right now in the Middle East, those are Abraham's fault. Okay, we can surely give him, because he didn't trust God, and he ended up having Ishmael. And Ishmael became the father of the Arab nation, who became the father of the Islamic nation. All of them traced their roots back to Abraham, who started in this little town of Ur as just a normal shopmaker. So, questions? Anything you didn't get?